Hello, I'm Jack Underwood.
And I'm Rachel Allen.
And you're listening to the second series of the Faber Poetry Podcast. In the studio this week, we have Will Harris and Joe Dunthorne and audio postcards from Simon Armitage, Heather Crystal and Isabel Gallimore.
This poem is taken from a sequence of poems I'm working on called New Cemetery. And they are all fairly short and untitled pieces, loosely based around the area of West Yorkshire where I live and the house that I live in. So it's odd to be recording and reading this poem in Brooklyn, in New York, where I'm living at the moment, which explains the aeroplanes you might hear in the background that are going overhead to JFK Airport. Although we do have aeroplanes in Huddersfield as well. The blind, undying loyalty to simple things, their cruel, unkillable faith in return. Devoted wristwatch, faithful comb. This leather belt still bearing the brunt after 40 years. This shaving brush, whispering toady, decades of lather and baseless worship, a daily smear of fawning, obsequious praise. This snakeskin wallet, for his 18th, was it? Happy to lend and lend. These six-hole oxblood DMs. By thee I stood, my liege, through avalanche and rockfall, till the flashing blue lights arrived. This silver pen, its fuselage tooled for better grip, the keen nib still primed to chart even the shallowest thought.
That was a poem by Simon Armitage, kicking off our second series of the Faber Poetry Podcast. Simon's new book, Sandetti Light Vessel Automatic, is out now with Faber. Rachel, here we are.
Back in the studio.
Back in the old studio.
How are you feeling to be back?
I'm good. I've like put a new photo on the inside of my locker. You know, I've found my old PE kit in there.
I have a new pencil case. But you don't have a coffee, which makes me think that maybe you're not drinking caffeine. A lot can change in a year.
Yes, I have. I've had a coffee holiday, but I did have one this morning.
Naughty.
You know, the old nerves.
Yeah.
Jangling.
Yeah.
The new season.
I've quit coffee for like a week and a half.
How are you feeling?
Horrific. All I want to do is bathe in it.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited about this series because we've got some incredible guests and postcards coming up.
We have, yeah. Are we allowed to say who we've got coming up?
I think so. To entice people, we've got poem postcards from luminaries such as Morgan Parker, Jericho Brown, Daisy Lafarge, and we've got guests like Ray Armantrout, Don Patterson, Fiona Benson, and Joe Dunthorne, who is someone that we'll be speaking to today.
So yeah, it's been a very busy interim period, really, since the last series. There's been some books coming out.
What are you into at the moment? What have you read lately that's like blown your mind?
I've just been reading Anthony Anasaguru's new book. We've got him coming on later in the series. I think that's going to be amazing.
Yeah, that book is earth-shatteringly good.
It's very good. What else? The Morgan Parker, who we have an audio postcard from, her book Magical Negro is like really impressive and sort of vital reading for me at the moment.
I've been reading, so Michael L. Craig, any opportunity I talk about the sort of American, I would say he's a surrealist poet, who has a new book out with Wave, I think right now, called Woods and Clouds Interchangeable. And he's also the title king.
Talkativeness.
Talkativeness.
That's a good one.
Can You Relax in My House was his first book title.
I can, in a thin kimono. which is another,
which is his second book title.
Yeah, yeah. I'm up to speed on Michael L. Craig.
I've also been obsessed with this poet called Mio Vestrini, who is translated by Anne Boyer and Cassandra Gillig. And the book's called Grenade in Mouth, and it's just such a revolutionary feminist poetic text published in the US. So if you can seek that out, it will change your world.
Definitely. I think there's a new book by Emily Pettit that I'm quite excited to read.
Cool.
And I think, isn't Paige Lewis's book is coming out? Their book is coming out. I'm really looking forward to that. I've got that on the pre-order.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah. There's loads of stuff in the pipeline, I think. And yeah.
Hopefully we'll be able to cover quite a bit of it as the season progresses.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to our here and now. Rachel, who have we got in the studio today?
Will Harris is an assistant editor at the Rialto and a fellow of the Complete Works 3. Published in the Blood Axe anthology, 10 Poets of the New Generation, he was featured in the Evening Standard magazine as part of the New Guard of London Poets. His poem Say was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best Single Poem 2018, and he won a poetry fellowship from the Arts Foundation in 2019. His debut pamphlet of poems, All This Is Implied, published by Happenstance in 2017, was joint winner of the London Review Bookshop Pamphlet of the Year. Mixed Race Superman, an essay, was published by Peninsula Press in 2018 and will be published in an expanded edition by Melville House. His first full poetry collection, Rendang, is forthcoming from Granter in 2020. Will Harris, what poems would you like to read for us today?
Okay, I thought I'd read an extract from a longer poem. It's called All the Birds Your Husband. One day, I heard a woman started writing poems to a friend with cancer. Not to comfort, but to mock him. And when he died, she wrote poems to his wife. Mocked her, too. She told her that the birds in her garden were him, her husband. So she would sit outside and feed them stale crumbs until they flapped away. And then she raged. Strange things started happening. Her lights blew, strings snapped on an unused harp. She shouted at the new birds. One of them flew straight into her room, shitting, screaming. What of the poet? She scolded the wife in her most mocking poem yet. No, all the birds, your husband.
Thank you.
We're also joined today by Joe Dunthorne, whose debut, O Positive, has just been published by Faber. Joe's first novel, Submarine, was published in 2008. It's since been translated into 16 languages and adapted for a film by Richard Ayoade. His second novel, Wild Abandon, came out in 2011 and won the 2012 Encore Award. His latest is The Adulterants in 2018. And his poems have been published all over the place. Poetry Review, London Review of Books, and New Statesman. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
What would you like to read for us today?
I'm going to read a bird poem as well. This poem is about a father who believes his daughter is falling in love with some owls. It's called Owls in Law. These birds have no idea how to behave, pouring glasses of water for just themselves, regurgitating pellets of compressed bone, and now landing on my daughter's arms. As she laughs, their apertured eyelids click. When she asks which of them are single, their lighthouse smiles sweep the room. That night, I watch my daughter sleep. I'm at her bedside, there in the eaves. As she starts to dream, her eyes toil in their sockets. I warn the owls not to mistake this twitching for field mice and pluck them out. I know from research the power of their zygodactyl talons. Their wings are silent when they descend, claws now trimmed and tagged with commitment rings. Her eyes stay shut as they grip her clavicles, rising gently between rafters. They hide in a darkness to which my sight cannot adjust. I listen for her cries, but hear only deepening breath.
Thank you so much. We always ask our writers to bring in a little item that's indicative of their poetic practice, or as much as they can do that for a kind of impossible question and task. Joe, what did you bring in for us?
I should warn you that my thing is potentially very pretentious, but it is an old-fashioned typewriter. It's actually not that old-fashioned. It's kind of like an 80s typewriter, which I really like because, well, for a number of reasons. I like because you can't edit. You can't edit in the normal way, so it kind of gives you a bit of forward motion. I like the sound it makes, and I thought that might be good for this podcast, so I'll give you a little sample.
He's live writing a poem now.
Just written something really, really wow. Great. And then you know you're doing really well when you get the old...
I don't think Rachel's eyes do look like that.
Hang on, wait.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, there they do, yeah, I see it, yeah.
That's just weird.
The magic ding.
But of course, when you're writing poems, you don't normally get to the end of the line, so you actually miss out on the ding.
But the ding is like a separate thing. If you press return, do you get a ding every...
No, that's the sign of the return, just like that.
And that resets the dinger?
That resets the dinger, because...
Why does it ding when you get to the end of the line?
It's kind of just an encouragement thing.
Yeah, celebration.
Like a little reward.
Well done.
So you don't have to look up to see that you got to the line? I don't know.
Yes, because it's ding and then you swipe it across.
Yeah, without even looking.
Yeah, which is quite...
Have you written on this? Have you actually written...
Well, the thing is, obviously you would never want to write anything long on this, which is why I like writing poems on it. I generally don't write anything over a page. I usually do it in the morning as like my first free writing exercise and just do whatever comes to mind. And I don't use it except in that circumstance. So it's just my little...
This is like your meditation app.
Yeah, it's my meditation app. And also it creates a beautiful object. You know, when you get to the end of having written a poem on a typewriter, you've got this nicely printed thing. You can do loads of cool things with lineation and word spacing is really, really fun. And there's all these quite weird old-fashioned, like on here you can put in like 3/4 and 5/8 and fun little symbols, and you can write in red as well as black.
Oh, that's really cool.
For like complaint letters.
Exactly. So when I really mean a poem, I write it in red.
Yeah.
It's just really fun, and I like having the like stack of typewritten poems, which obviously I then pick out the ones that seem okay and work on them.
What can you
on the computer.
What can you see when you're... What's your sort of... Your HUD, your head-up display, your sights...
What you mean?
On the typewriter. Like, can you see...
The alphabet, Jack.
Well, yeah. But I mean, like, of the page itself. Because it seems like when you're on Microsoft Word or other word processing apps are available, when you're looking at a page like that, you can see the bottom, like, quite a large chunk of the page as the text, like... goes on it, whereas I think because of the way it scrolls round, you can only see like one line appearing at a time, which is like
also you can have this quite anxious period where you don't know where the page is going to run out because the bottom of the page will disappear into the mechanism. So as you're reaching like the bottom quarter of the page, you think you get this kind of pressure of like I could run out of space quite soon. I don't quite know when, which creates a kind of not quite Olympian, but like some sort of fun constraint.
Where
you feel the door is closing and you have to kind of get the poem done.
Yeah.
Did you write the short poems in your book on the typewriter?
What? It's actually a fairly recent affectation. I'm not sure any of the poems in this book were written on it. I'm sorry to report.
But I think it's interesting that like we talk about form being like very much like what you can see on the page, a sort of very visual thing. But of course, like the process of writing a poem, those first drafts are often, there's a different line that runs through the poem, this sort of rhetorical arc. And it's interesting how small things like that, like little pressures of not knowing when the end of the page is coming or needing to get out of the house quickly or your beard being on fire or something. There must be like poems have been, the shapes of poems, the sort of rhetorical arc of a poem is as much like, which is much part of its form. And it's interesting how material things might.
Well, especially with an ending, because there's that sense of what you love in an ending of a poem is something that surprises you and moves sideways and just doesn't do what you're expecting. And I feel like my instinct, and maybe lots of people's instinct, is to end a poem in an ending-y way, which is not what you want. But when you've got something pressurizing you, be it time or form, you often end up just going, I need to get out, how can I do it? And then you end up going somewhere that's much more surprising.
Didn't like Jack Kerouac use just like a huge roll, and he would just like write nonstop until the whole roll was finished? So he's kind of doing the opposite, and that kind of fed into his style.
Yeah, a lot of people say that's a big mistake for old Jack. Yeah.
Maybe he should have written on very small pieces of paper instead.
Just well, like I don't know.
Postcards.
Yeah, so what's the thing?
And A.I. Ammons, the poet, used very narrow paper, didn't he?
Really? Wow.
Yeah, so those like the tape poems, I think they're called, they're very narrow because they had to...
Well, I saw Eileen Miles reading the other day and her kind of, you know, talismanic... narrow poems. She was like, "They just got really narrow notebooks. That's why my poems are narrow."
I wonder what the opposite of this would be. Just like a papered room that you could just like write really minuscule text endlessly on, or something.
I was talking my partner's an artist, and we were talking about like why people don't write like they do paint. Like, imagine if you had to like were working on like a canvas and you had to write in like really large letters. Like how that would change your relationship to
I think
it.
I would like that.
What huge?
Yeah.
Or, like, you're only allowed to make poems in, like, the blocks that children have with the alphabet on. And, they've got to support themselves, like, into physically.
Yeah.
I suppose, like, actually, I remember when the first time I encountered an Excel spreadsheet, and I was an adult. I don't know. That gives you some idea of my professional background. And I was sort of, like, trying to find something, and I was pressing, you know, across. And I suddenly realised that it was never ending. That I was generating new blocks.
Infinity Excel.
So that might be the program for somebody who wants.
Someone's definitely done that. I think.
Written a poem just endlessly from left to right, no line break.
Yeah, it's out there.
Probably.
Yeah, but the Word Doc is kind of a similar thing. Do you worry about it? It has, you know, there's like the infinite freedom of this.
It kind of stresses me out when you think about all the ways that it's infinite, but then all the ways that it's like absolutely contained, which is just form in general, I guess. Doesn't have to just be the thing on the page.
Yeah.
But Microsoft Word seems to hate poetry, doesn't it?
Yeah. Really, you have to like go back and decapitalize or capitalize stuff.
There's bound to be a way you can turn that off. In fact, somebody told me that they did know a way of turning that off.
But the fact that you have to Google it to find out.
Yeah, I know.
That's how they get you.
I think actually it'd be much better.
Keep you in jobs you hate because you can't decapitalize the first line of your poem.
Is that how you became a novelist?
That's right. My friend writes poems on his iPad. Which always just like blows my mind. And I don't know if that just means I'm a full old person now, but I'm just like, whoa.
Does he use the pen or does he just like tap on the screen?
I think he just like taps on the screen.
What is it about iPads that's become very like old person?
They feel like leisure to me.
They really
I can't imagine.
My mum
like,
loves it.
Yeah. But there's lots of like parents hunched over
they
iPads.
They love tablets.
Well, David Hockney does all his art on an iPad now, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool. I love those iPad
they're
paintings.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
you
they're amazing.
You can see them, the adults, with the iPads very close to their face. The
maybe they're all
on.
painting
or tapping away. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get into a sort of ageist stereotype, but there's a vibe. They're not youthful, are they?
Well, what talisman have you brought in for us today?
So I was thinking about this. I've brought my bag.
Okay.
And that might not seem like a talisman, but I feel like my bag kind of is a talisman in that it is something I take everywhere. And it also represents me in a way. I feel like it's not really that age-appropriate a bag. It's quite like a kind of like school bag. It's a bit scruffy, too big. I've got like a pack of Smarties that exploded in there and I still haven't cleared out.
That's proper school bag.
Yeah. I'm just looking through it.
Can we have a look at the bag? Put it up on the table.
I've got a lot of books. I carry too many books with me. I've got a water bottle. I've got a keep cup. I've got one of my favourite things is this bag in a bag.
Bag in a bag.
Bag? I've got a bag. Not a cag in a bag. A bag in a bag.
What's a cag in a bag?
It's a cagoule in a bag.
No. I would love to have...
Yeah, I'll be on my iPad later writing this up.
I've got a Canavans Peckham Pool Club card.
Oh, nice, yeah.
I've probably got a Nando's card somewhere in there.
Floating around. That's wild.
I've got quite a lot of random medicines, like cough syrup, just in case. Some teepees, T-tips.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Recently saw a hygienist and they were recommended to me. I think, and it also kind of represents my, like, maybe this like fear, I don't know if you have it, that I need to bring everything with me.
Totally.
Like that everything could just collapse at any moment and that I need to have what I need.
I really relate to that.
Not like full-on survivalist, but in that spirit.
No, I completely relate to that. At all times, I have, like, my pencil case, a makeup bag, my laptop, and, like, various other, like, little bits and pieces because I'm constantly travelling. I like this idea of just, like, having all, like bringing in the essentials, and the essentials just like showing you what you are daily, or like, okay, I am these things. I have these like minimal things around me. And I guess you carry your poems around in your bag when you're taking your poems place to place to do readings.
But these are the props of your performativity.
My trade.
Yeah.
I guess I do travel around a lot, like Rachel. And so, yeah, you kind of get used to just taking everything with you, and then you start to just...
It feels like it's quite a poety thing. I can think of, in my head, lots of my poet friends, I visualise them with a big, kind of slightly unwieldy, turtle-like backpack.
I went out for my friend's birthday the other night, and we were all, like, getting a bit drunk, and her sister was like, Rachel, why do you always bring your laptop to the club? Because I had this, like, massive rucksack. I was like, so I'm going to the library tomorrow.
Well, Emily Berry can always be found with a packet of oatcakes about her person. Yes. That's, like, a well-known... She never leaves... I don't think she leaves the house without one.
I mean, why would you? That's the perfect snack.
It is very good.
I used to bring nuts with me. So you don't just buy a chocolate bar when you're hungry?
Oh, so you just eat nuts?
Yeah, well, the nuts is the thing. It's like in my like better periods, I'll bring nuts.
I think probably they're more calorific though than nut, aren't they?
But that's good, isn't it?
Oh, that's good. Well, rather than buying a chocolate bar,
You think a chocolate bar is better for you than nuts? This is.
I've never had a good period.
I think the idea of having a talisman is quite scary, because if you confer power on that thing, then if you lose it, then where does that leave you? You're screwed. No more poems.
So don't lose your rucksack. I like the difference between what you guys bought in. You've bought in this, like, I don't want to say like cumbersome, because it came in a really handsome plastic carry case, but it's definitely not every day like the rucksack. It's kind of like a ostentatious display of writerliness.
Would you take it to a cafe and use it?
No, I wouldn't. I hide it. It is slightly shameful. I acknowledge that. But on that note of like that, if your talisman is somehow essential, I think that's true of like all writing comfortness, that essentially I feel like, obviously I can't carry this quite cumbersome typewriter with me anywhere, and I try to avoid as much as possible having things I need, like that's by trains and buses. You have to feel like that's your special place rather than needing like your chamomile tea and your whatever.
Do you think that the fact that it's a kind of quite a deliberate object, it's a fetish, is that fair to say, as well as a talisman? Do you think that that works towards how you sort of like think about poems? I think about like, I guess like that poems, maybe if you write novels as well, are kind of luxurious items.
I mean, and this is kind of like, hate to say it, but that you're completely right. Like maybe it's not poetry enough, but I think of them as a source of pleasure and a fun thing. As I was talking to Will earlier on, saying that there's something that's quite scary about having your first collection out, in that you kind of become a poet, or you become announce yourself in some way. And I really enjoyed the very long period of time when I felt unofficial, and that poems were this thing I just went to because I loved them. And I did feel the last couple of days trying to write poems on my typewriter, a certain self-consciousness, like, oh, now it's, you know, it kind of, something had changed.
It's nice that it returns you to it being fun or a game or something as well. If you have an extra little bit of like a prop or something to make it new and enjoyable again.
Completely.
Your first book has just come out, which is such an overwhelming, brilliant time. And Will, you're working on your first book right now. How did you both, and how are you finding the processes of coming to having first collections of poems out? The gathering together, the sort of making it a complete work.
I think I feel a similar thing to Joe. Like we were saying, that period of emerging, I feel like now as I'm fearing like being emergent, having emerged, I'm like cherishing the like time underwater. I kind of imagine it as being like underwater.
I feel like it's wormy. It's like, oh, I'm a worm, and then I'm like emerging into the light. Like right. Whenever people say emerging, I'm like, the worm's coming out.
Right. Which is bad, because then the beak comes for you. And,
then the bird comes.
Cuts,
and then
like, scissors
dead.
You in half, yeah.
And there's not much going on for worms above ground, actually, is there, really?
That's what
all
I mean.
All that's good is underground, yeah. Part of me just wants to burrow deeper, yeah. The logic of capitalism is always towards emerging upwards.
And I guess but I guess you have to be Salinger to do a full disappearing act. Yeah. But it's so tempting, though, isn't it, just to think.
Have you considered that?
Well,
you've had a different, I mean, you have emerged in one sense, like, because you have this other career as...
Right. Yeah.
That one head of the worm is
yeah.
You're a worm.
Oh, I'm one of those worms that can split, be cut in two, but then they
yeah.
become.
Yeah, yeah. I think you've always been conjoined as a mono sapien.
Mono-sapien.
I don't know, yeah. but maybe just your novelist yeah. worm head has been poking out for a while.
It's actually surprisingly different emerging with the other head. I think I have felt that fiction provides an extra shield against it being you. You know, it's explicitly fiction, whereas poetry, for however much it is fiction, carries this connection to you, the person, that is a bit more direct. And
how do you both treat these different writerly heads that you have to sort of put on for either form, if you do feel like you have to differentiate yourself that way? And do the two sort of bleed into each other? Do you feel like poetry is close to prose? Because I feel like when I speak to poets, or when I listen to poets speak, there's often something that they'll like lean poetry up against. I was listening to Michael L. Craig actually do a talk at the University of Montana, and he was saying how he used to write really surreal, sort of like absurd short fiction, but he felt like poetry housed it better. So his poems are just like versified short stories, basically. I just wondered how you sort of managed your prose alongside your poems.
I guess the way I've been thinking about it recently, when I'm writing prose, I've mainly written essays. I'm trying to put together an argument, and you know, you have a kind of responsibility to the argument, and also it feels like you're making it in the real world in a slightly different way to poems. Is in people will read it as a kind of serious, in a different way, especially if you're talking about politics. You know, it's a serious argument which involves things which exist in the world. So I've come to see poetry as this kind of separate domain of play in which there are no rules. And maybe I didn't think of it that way so much before when I was just writing poetry. But now I think of poetry as defined by the lack of rules, by the fact I can use it to do anything and to experiment and to just kind of mess around with different things.
So it's perhaps a case that it doesn't have to be as responsible to something as maybe prose does?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've come to definitely associate it more with my subconscious mind, maybe, or that, and that's what's most interesting about it, as this kind of hard, kind of short-circuiting the brain, the conscious brain.
I think whether you've read like language theory or not, or you've just had some practical experiences of writing poetry, you understand that you're accessing a kind of truth or something that's an uncertain or stranger kind of version of the truth, but you kind of feel it being true. But it's not the kind of truth that you'd want to, you know, build political policy on, you know. And I think when you're writing in prose or the language of argument, at least, you're suddenly returning language to a situation in which it has to be sort of like agreed upon terms, testable, and the knowledge that you're working to an agreed knowledge rather than one that's kind of like floating, you know, oscillatory around some sort of great big absence or something.
Would both of you like to maybe read another poem?
Okay. This one is called Sestina for My Friends. I know what my friends are thinking because of the things they say. Joe, you are shiny and worthwhile and always thinking of others. I am not so great. I could name at least 5 people who are better. Here's one of my faults. I'm forever calculating how to present myself in any given situation. Calculating people give W.G. Sebald's Rings of Saturn as a gift and think that the person receiving the book will think better of them. After reading it, they will say, Joe, it was beautiful. I mean, he's like the great gramps I never had. He even made Suffolk compelling. I always give Rings of Saturn as a gift, sometimes even to boys. Always is too much. I've given it twice, if I'm calculating honestly. Once to a girl who thought I was great for just over a month until she suspected, correctly, that I think I am more interesting than her. If I say that the boy I gave it to was better at football than me, then I think you understand. Better to be left for dead on the right wing, always knowing that the boy who embarrassed you, let's say his name is Luke, has this book in his bedroom.
I'm calculating that he won't have sold it because he thinks, nay, hopes, that one day he might read it, this great and clever book that was a gift from a friend who is not great at football, but by God, he's got a brain, and ultimately, it's better to have enormous thoughts than to be almost semi-pro. I think great people do not have these kinds of thoughts. I always keep my mauled copy somewhere half inconspicuous, calculating a spot where guests will see it, sure, but will not say, I bet Joe put that there so I see it. More likely they'll say, huh, such a clever book just lying there next to his football boots. It's great to know someone like Joe who is clever but doesn't rub your face in it. Calculating people are the worst in existence. This poem is better for its honesty. Even when I admit all this stuff, my friends can always fall back on my honesty. He thinks too much, they think. We had best not say anything about that Sestina. He'll always be great to us. Better than great. More like excellent. Or this is what I'm calculating.
Amazing. I love that poem because for a Sestina, you've really chosen to just undo the absolute matter of what makes a poem, but you've done it in the hardest poem form ever. I love it.
I think also just like the having the your end words, which are of course like the thing that makes a good Sestina really. That's what you've got to work with. Get those good end ones in the first. Get them in early. And then yeah. And you're set up for life. But you, calculating is one of them?
Yeah, calculating... Better. They're quite nothingy.
But they're
thinking, say, always great, better calculating.
Yeah, but they even there, you're kind of like already getting into the sort of like unpleasant self-consciousness of it with like those words. They're really primed for sort of like even second guessing or double.
Yes, they're kind of doubling back on themselves.
Yeah, sort of yeah. Thing. And so by the time we get to the end, there's really sort of no escape.
Well, would you like to read another poem for us?
Buddleia not Buddha, chanting in bloom, my soul before I knowed it, chanting too, I ran down to the tube and from Gray's Inn to Farringdon to the Golden Lane estate, Buddleia not Buddha, chanting in bloom. I went not caring where I went, how late it was or why, but barred at every turn I took and every church gate chained, Buddleia not Buddha, chanting in bloom. Grey it grew and far from home until I had to stop. My bundling found me on a bus and eyes closed there I cried, waiting for the sky to gape and let me crawl inside. Buddleia, not Buddha, chanting in bloom. Buddleia, not Buddha, buddling on my tomb.
Thank you so much. I love both of your poems. I kind of want to talk about humour in both of your poetry, but I don't want to reduce... Well, actually, I don't think talking about humour reduces a poem because humour is perhaps the hardest thing to access in poetry, maybe, because we don't expect it when we read a poem. And it's really, really hard to write a poem that will make someone laugh. And also, I find it so rare to read a poem that will make me laugh.
I think poems are inherently funny. And it's something to do with what you were saying earlier, Joe. This idea that, I mean, they're these short little things. And in each poem, you're kind of announcing yourself. And the idea of re-announcing yourself so many times in such a short space is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
And there's something, yeah, showy about them, always. Yes, I mean, yes. To me, I mean, that's like the first thing
it's
that
like,
always
and
strikes
one more
me.
Thing.
The artificial. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're like constructing this little self, this little scenario, and there's something always a bit absurd.
Because
like,
they're arch, yeah. aren't they? You're always starting and ending. You know, it's always... Yeah.
It's funny how that when you have like those sitcoms that have been running for years, like in the first couple of series, when someone comes in and says like what is obviously going to be their catchphrase or whatever, they step in, the audience applauds because they've arrived, you know, their favorite character or whatever. But by the 10th series, there's not even a fourth wall. They're just arriving and then they're just sort of like, yeah, hi, it's really me. I'm here. Maybe that's kind of what happens over time with poems. That sort of a little bit.
I'm interested in what you can do with humor when you repeat it enough or undercut it or use humor in ways that feel, you know, what is it to laugh at a poem that isn't, you know, it's on a subject that isn't supposed to be funny, or what happens when you use it as a kind of, either it's missing, i.e. the funny subject isn't funny and how does that feel, or the subject is supposed to be weighty, is kind of you have the rug pulled out of you by laughing.
I think there's one of my favorite lines in your poems is I think it's every time I head the ball, I feel a poem evaporate about sort of things I love. What's that poem called?
In which I practice happiness.
And I just think that's really dark. That image is so dark. Like, it's about sort of damage and putting sensation first and putting like pure joy first above like intellect. But for some reason, that line always just makes me like laugh out loud because I can see it so clearly in my head.
I guess that feeling as well of like connecting with a football, kind of you hear the ball go bong, you know, and that sort of like
it's a slapstick sort of image.
Yeah, that kind of airy thing. That probably is what a poem sounds like when it just dies in the head. There's something about the bothness of humour, though, isn't there? That often it comes from like creating a context in one gear and then placing something other or different. Yeah. And that's like... That's of course like central to how poetry works, or what it is like, trying to bring the full complexity of reality somehow within reach without, you know, dulling it through abstract means. So, and often, and if you do look at the totality of reality as far as we can, there's always something like odd or at odds,
and you're constantly falling short of it, which is funny, right? Falling short of something, like falling down, are both kind of funny acts. And especially with poetry, because there's you always, I feel like, fighting against this expectation of high diction, of like grand sentiment, of this like exposition of some universal truth, and the reality of like the ball and the poem and the evaporating, you know, nothingness.
Well, it's funny, if you are a funny poet, nobody ever says, you know, tell me about the role of seriousness in your work. Do you know what I mean? There's sort of like, it's only the other way around. It's that, I think Jennifer L. Knox says that poetry's greatest trope is gravity. And that seems like an interesting... It's a good line.
That's a great conversation-stopping line.
But I imagine that she's a poet who's probably very tired of having to answer questions about being funny.
Maybe you don't want to be a cheerleader for it, but I think it's really important to, when you know, again, I'm talking about Michael Ole Craig constantly, but one of his poems, Tomatoes Disrespect Us, which is one of my favourite poems of all time, and one of the best titles ever. Yeah. I was laughing out loud at that poem, and from that point he became one of my favourite poets, and it's, I don't know, we talk about seriousness
and
Selina
Hill.
Yeah.
Another poet who... Yeah.
It's really funny to me, and you can, you know, things that are...
The kind of darkness and the funny and the gravity in her work, it's all kind of comes together.
Nothing's ever just funny, is it?
No, unless I think like there is a real emptiness at the heart of something that's just funny. Like, if you've ever been to see Jimmy Carr's like show, he does like he just does the one-liners. He does like 100, and in a way, it's the purity of the. He's going for this pure thing where it's just a joke, and it's just he's making people laugh. That's the whole thing. And I remember this time I went to Edinburgh Festival. I saw lots of comedy. And it did actually feel really, really empty. Obviously, this is not fair. There's lots of great stand-up that has more to it. But a joke, because it's got this automatic response from the body, it can leave you feeling quite, like, hollow. I'm happy, but what am I happy about? Whereas I think, you know, it would be hard for a poem, like Jack says, it's really not possible to write a poem that doesn't have something else going on.
Tethering the humour.
Right. It's kind of linked into the title of your book as well, which is a joke, which is kind of funny, half funny and quite dark as well, maybe.
Right, exactly. And I think that's a fun thing to play with.
O Positive is the title.
Yeah, it's called O Positive. I think it's great to force a reader into a kind of bodily response and at the same time counterbalance that with something cerebral. That feels like a good counterbalance.
That strange thing of like something being like off and on, like that, like it's kind of like, oh, that's from somewhere else, but it's kind of terrifyingly relevant somehow, and that has to be that's a real skill, isn't it? I think to sort of to find the errant strange thing that somehow needs to be there.
And I guess both of your, a lot of your sequences in your books have quite wide-ranging narratives within them. And I was just thinking about the sort of like urge to tell a story or to have a narrative within a poem, or do you have that, or am I?
No, I do. I'm interested in how people narrate their own lives, how they construct a sense of themselves, their identity, how they put themselves across to others, which is, I guess, what a story is. I never thought of myself as a story teller or someone who likes stories, but I just inadvertently end up
in a lot of the poems just
things.
Contained fictions or contained sort of realities that you can sort of see in a like nebulous kind of bubble map that are joined somehow. That's how I see the structure of a lot of your poems and a lot of your sequences. Like they link to each other, but they're also mapped out in this very 3D way. And I'm really interested in poetry that's quite material and presents, you know, like a like the body. But I've never really thought about material as a kind of sequence of like maps or stories that you can see in an almost 3D way, like a video game. You know, like a video game map when you're like roaming around,
right.
like that.
Yeah.
That's how I see your poems.
Or the opening credits of Game of Thrones when you're going around all the different like cities.
Yeah, like that. That's what I'm trying to say.
Or yeah, those kind of early RPGs. Where you just go around and you just talk to people and you're trying to get clues to go to the next place.
Yeah. And I love that so much. I'm just like, what are they choosing for me to see right now? And what am I being taken away from?
I really like that point you made about strangeness. But I was thinking about how like anything really good is often perceived at first as being strange or even funny, maybe. I was thinking about that Wordsworth poem, The Thorn. How everyone just thought it was hilarious when it came out, like hilariously shit. And they were like, this is ridiculous. I can't believe someone wrote this. And there's this particular line about where this child was buried. And yeah, everyone thought it was just ridiculous. It was like funny. But now it's seen as, well, then it was seen as really great. And that's like the kind of process of like the evolution of art.
So it was
first,
seen as ridiculous
laugh,
at the
and
time.
And then they cry. Yeah. And then they find it boring. And then the cycle repeats itself.
I mean, if you think about something like time and history, the way that that erodes or changes the serious. I mean, codpieces were serious. Like they were they were really earnest. And those big collars, like people were, you know, if you mocked a man's codpiece, you'd be fighting to the death, wouldn't you? Or they're rough, Whereas now, if you turned up to work in either of those, it would be an act of like,
no, fight them to the death, Jack. Well, you can wear your codpiece.
Sure, maybe.
And you're rough.
I've just shamed myself out of it.
Thank you so much, Joe and Will, for joining us today and talking about your incredible poems. Joe Dunthorne's O Positive is out now with Faber. And Will Harris's All This Is Implied is out with Happenstance now. And also Mixed Race Superman with Peninsula Press. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Heather Crystal, and I'm in the dark in a closet seeing if I can remember all of the words to a poem called That Air of Ruthlessness in Spring, which is in a book that will be out in the UK in October. That Air of Ruthlessness in Spring. Here is the hand. Here is the hand on my face. It's not my hand. It's a beautiful day. Again. I can hardly believe anything. What about you, who are so frequently touching some part of the world? What is it you're touching today? When I touch the trees think, man-child. They are so wrong, but it is a human face I put on. I am hung up under this weather. I am hanging on tight to a swing. When I go up enough, I jump. Then I am not touching anything. Then the world thinks I've disappeared. I'm just having a little fun. Not much fun at all. Are you sad? Did you touch the world the wrong way? Everything is always happening, and not just for show. I want to show you something. I don't care what. I want you to look where I say.
I felt like it was like a child's reactions to things in the world around them. The speaking voice felt to me really childlike, the way that they were sort of giving directives, like, everything is always happening. I'm having a little fun. I'm not having any fun. It was this kind of really sort of primary, binary way of looking at things. Like, I want you to look over here. I love that naivety in a poem.
It's like there seems to be like an interest in like touching and connecting with the world in a way that's just like purely kind of exploratory without kind of a preconceived like way of navigating. It's quite sort of phenomenological.
Yeah, and like, none of the, so like all of those ideas of sensation, they don't necessarily have any consequences. It's like I am feeling this thing because of the weather, or I'm hanging up underneath this thing because of something else. Like, it doesn't necessarily feel like there are massive sort of emotional consequences that are also held within the poem.
It also seems to sort of loop back to itself, like the language refers to itself. So it's like there's this hand, and then the hand is like, the hand is like a beautiful day. Is it? I mean, that's a lovely sort of turn. And then there's the sort of touching of the trees, which think that the person is a man child. And then, like you say, having a little fun, which is also not much fun. It's like, I think it's kind of like trying to navigate this sort of overwhelmedness with a kind of like honest curiosity. And it's, I don't know, I feel like maybe, what's that, Baudelaire says like, that like the poet like a child is drunk. So I guess Baudelaire hung out with a lot of drunk kids.
But that would be the perfect kind of way into this poem in a way. But you wouldn't want to have that as an epigraph or something, because it would direct it too much. Like, you can come to that conclusion just by having the poem.
Yeah, and also I feel like maybe that what Baudelaire's sort of arguing there is that there's what we would consider to be sort of childish, which is a kind of an innocent or playfulness of, is not frivolity. It's kind of more like a more frank.
Well, it's serious play.
It's
like I'm playing, but it's serious because I'm learning.
Well, and we were at a talk, were we not, last night with Nua Al-Sadir, and she was sort of brilliantly talking about how a child almost has to sort of destroy things. She was talking about Winnicott, and how in Winnicott's theory, a child sort of destroys things in order to sort of test them so that they can be separate, separate enough from them to love. And I feel like there's almost, this poem has that kind of like pushing, touching, grabbing.
And I think about Sam Riviere, like one of my favourite lines of Sam Riviere's poetry, "I am a child at the opera of emotions," which is just that complete overwhelming ness of everything in life.
Well, I mean, having had a child recently, I envy their like her lack of obligation to sort of do things other than pursue her own interests, which would be ideal conditions for a poet, probably, rather than the more humdrum concerns of like laundry and such.
But that's what makes the poet. That's what makes the person. It's balancing those two.
Yeah.
You know, the carving out the little bit of space of time for yourself to have a poem time, and then having to do all the spreadsheets.
Like actually, the poet can't be drunk like a child always.
I mean, they can.
They perhaps have been.
I mean, we are. We,
but I think, like, you have to. Yeah, and you can't sort of like playfully have an interest in your inbox. Oh, how interesting this inbox is! When you've got to, you know, get shit done.
Yeah, you'd be exhausted.
It would.
You've got to save that for the poem.
Yeah, and maybe this is why like coffee holidays are also important. What else is there to say about this poem? I really love the way that it's sort of, there's a kind of, that in order to have that perspective, there's a kind of underlying threat of crisis. This is like the real.
The title speaks to that. That air of ruthlessness in spring.
Yeah.
In a poem like this, which presents a kind of lightness, the word ruthlessness is so massive and overbearing and sits on top of the poem almost, sort of directing how we're supposed to read it.
Yeah, there's a sort of brutality about the way that spring suddenly like fills everything with light.
A lot of people I know, actually, they hate spring. They're like, all this expectation and all this anticipation for change, and what if you're not feeling that kind of a way?
Yeah, how do you keep up with the world doing its thing?
Is spring ruthless?
It's the cruelest month, isn't it? April. Yeah.
So he says.
I don't know. I've got some pretty terrifying feelings about May, to be honest. I'm not looking forward to it.
And Jack, who's our final audio postcard from?
Our final audio postcard is from Isabel Gallimore, and it's a poem taken from her book Significant Other.
This poem is taken from Significant Other, my first collection published by Carknuts in March of this year. Spirit human. Let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel, the prowess of the lion. The deer's intuition tells us animals don't like to be shoes, because animals love to be shoes. Gummy sweets, similes, like people, they long to be airlifted from being themselves. Amongst candles, cheap incense, the hum of a fridge and the chatter of next door's animals, even when dog-tired, will pay attention and skill are needed in modelling themselves after retail assistants and chefs, after penniless artists and presidents, after all animals need to discover themselves.
You've been listening to the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen, produced by Jack Underwood, Rachel Allen, and Hannah Marshall for Faber and Faber. You can listen to us on all your favourite podcast platforms, and don't forget to tell your friends and subscribe.
Yeah.